Hello, everybody. Welcome again to the LSU Law Federalist Society chapter meeting. Today's event, the Law of McDonald's, Hot Coffee, Obesity, and Prank Phone Calls. It's a speech on tort reform. We have Ted Frank joining us and our very own Professor Bill Corbett. First of all, I just want to address something. I've heard from a lot of 1Ls there's a lot of confusion about what we're all about. So I'm going to read a little bit about us. First of all, welcome to the 1Ls. As president of the LSU Federalist Society, I personally would like to welcome you to the Paul M. Mabear Law Center. Over the next 3 years, you'll be trying to learn how our legal system works and what the law is. Unfortunately, some instructors may focus on how they think the law ought to be. This may be understandable in a university environment where practicality gives way to theory. However, theirs is not the only view of the world of law, and that is one reason for the Federalist Society. The Society seeks to broaden the debate and provide an alternative view to that often encountered in law schools across the nation. To quote from the Federalist Society's statement of purpose, law schools and the legal profession are currently strongly dominated by a form of orthodox liberal ideology which advocates a centralized and uniform society. While some members of the academic community have dissented from these views, by and large they are taught simultaneously with, and indeed as if they were, the law. The Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies is a group of conservatives and libertarians interested in the current state of the legal order. It is founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what it should be. The Society seeks both to promote an awareness of these principles and to further their application through its activities. Not all learning can be had from books. Much is learned in law school through contact with thinkers, judges, and civic leaders. But even more valuable is thoughtful debate between you and your friends and colleagues. The Federalist Society, by broadening the law school debate with its publications and invited speakers, provides a forum for a fuller inquiry into today's legal issues than you will receive from your textbooks. I encourage you to participate in Federalist Society activities and invite you to join. Now, that being said, we have no problem with liberals and people from other political persuasions being in the Federalist Society. We welcome all points of view. We welcome you to get engaged in our question and answer session that we'll have at the end. We even welcome you to join. It's only $5. These are at the end of the row. I'd like to ask you to pass them down so that everybody can have one. You simply just fill out your information, put your check in, and mail it off. You get in the mail Harvard Journal of Law. That's a great little book. I used it actually last summer when I was clerking at a firm. There was an article in there that was on point. So without further ado, let's get this started. Oh, also there's a sign-up sheet. Make sure to sign your names so that we can keep you on the email list of when we're having activities.
Hi, I'm Ted Frank. Very happy to be here. I went to high school in New Orleans, and it's good to be back in Baton Rouge. Sorry so few people are sitting in the first two rows, because I was going to engage in some crowd questioning over the McDonald's. But we'll just go with the talk. I'm going to talk about three cases which what they have in common is that McDonald's is a defendant. But they also have some other thematic issues in common, and we'll discuss that as we get to there. You've heard of some of these cases, maybe even all of them, but just as a caveat to begin with, I'm going to criticize the idea courts being overly sympathetic to plaintiffs and awarding damages just because they're seriously injured, I want to caution not to go too far in the other direction. We're going to be talking about plaintiffs who have suffered actual injuries and in some cases some really severe and unfortunate injuries, and the fact that some of these plaintiffs have also done some very, very stupid things does not mean that we shouldn't recognize that these are real injuries and real people behind the facts of the cases. We'll start with one that just about everybody's familiar with, the McDonald's coffee case, most famously known. This happened in the 90s. 79-year-old Stella Liebeck was a passenger in a car driven by her son. She purchased a 49-cent cup of coffee at McDonald's. The driver pulled over so that she could add cream and sugar to her coffee. She held the cup of coffee in her lap. As she was opening the lid, she spilled the entire contents in her lap. Since she was wearing cotton sweatpants, the sweatpants held the hot liquid to her skin, causing severe burns because she essentially sat marinating in the coffee for over a minute and a half. And when you sit in the hot liquid for that long, you're going to get some severe burns, and she did. She got third-degree burns, and there's no question that those are horrific injuries. She sued McDonald's, and her lawyer had the theory that any beverage that is more than 140 degrees is unreasonably dangerous and shouldn't be sold at all, and anybody who sells it is strictly liable for any injuries that are caused by the beverage, even if it's somebody spilling the beverage on themselves, as happened to Ms. Liebeck. McDonald's, for whatever reason, did not handle the trial very well. One of their executives testified in a deposition that a beverage that hot was simply undrinkable, which is factually false, as any of you who have, I mean, McDonald's coffee might be undrinkable, but it's not because it's too hot. And they had an expert witness who said, yes, you know, there have been previous burn cases in McDonald's, and if it's a McDonald's employee spilling coffee on somebody, we'll pay for any injury caused by that. But when you look at the fact that we sell billions of cups of coffee, you know, of course we're going to have a few hundred spills and the occasional burn, and those cases are statistically insignificant. And the jury took the term statistically insignificant to mean that the victims were insignificant. And that unfortunate misunderstanding led them to hold McDonald's liable and then impose punitive damages. The damages awarded were $160,000 or so in actual damages, and then another $2.7 million in punitive damages. Some problems with that. We'll start with the punitive damages aspect. The very act of selling coffee is that this sort of wanton behavior that we want to stop as a society. You can argue that, you know, maybe we as a society don't want hot beverages, and that the lawyer is right and no beverage should ever be served above 140 degrees. But that's a decision that should perhaps be made by a legislature or other elected officials rather than a 12-person jury imposing multi-million dollar punitive damages on a corporation that is essentially offering what the market wants. And the fact of the matter is that coffee is supposed to be hot. If it's not hot, it's going to be inferior in quality. And in fact, Starbucks sells coffee even hotter than McDonald's does. One of the urban legends that has arisen around this case is that McDonald's coffee was somehow unusually hot, and that's just simply not true. Every fast food organization or coffee vendor does get sued for causing burns, and that's Starbucks, that's Dunkin' Donuts, Burger King, you name it. They'll all have lawsuits at one point or another because somebody spills coffee on themselves or has coffee spilled on them, and they'll sue over that. Now, but going back to the punitive damages, part of the punitive damages were awarded on the basis, well, that's 2 days of coffee sales for McDonald's. And that seems improper to me. If you're going to base punitive damages on the size of a company, you're not punishing them for bad behavior, you're punishing them for being big. So that's one problem with the case. But the largest problem with the case is the entire theory of liability, that the injury here was caused by the person spilling coffee on themselves. And instead, the theory of the suit is that it's McDonald's fault for selling the coffee in the first place. Now, still alive at 79 years old, she surely has some experience in the world. She knows that coffee is hot, and she knows that you shouldn't spill coffee on yourself, and that if you do spill coffee on yourself, you shouldn't sit in it for a minute and a half. And for whatever reason, the jury imposed that liability. And this became a cause celebre. It was a subject of late-night talk show jokes. It was a Seinfeld episode based on it. And the fact that we're still talking about it 17 years later shows how it captured the popular imagination. This concerned the trial lawyer associations. And they could have had a very simple defense, which is, yes, there are lots of lawsuits like this where people sue over spilled coffee, and 95% of the courts get it right. They throw the case out. There's a very famous case written by the judge I clerked for, Judge Easterbrook, called McMahon versus Bunimatic, and threw the case out. There's no duty to warn for something that's an open and obvious danger, such as coffee being hot. The House of Lords in Great Britain was confronted with several hot coffee cases and faced with the question, do you impose liability for selling hot coffee? And in the case of Bogle versus McDonald's, the High Court of Great Britain said, you don't do that. But instead, what happened is that the trial lawyers have sought to defend the case, and not just defend the case, but say this is the epitome of what the justice system should be. And that concerns me. And it's getting taught in some law schools like that, too, and that concerns me. There have been some urban legends that have grown up around the suit, such as, oh, the McDonald's coffee was unusually hot, and as we discussed, that's not true. Or a relevant fact, such as, well, McDonald's had hundreds of injuries before that, and again, you're talking about a company that served billions of cups of coffee, and 1 in 23 million of them caused an injury. That's an example of a safe product, not an unreasonably dangerous product. So then the question becomes, you know, why just blame the coffee manufacturer for selling hot coffee? Stella Liebeck was wearing cotton sweatpants. If she was instead wearing Gore-Tex, the coffee wouldn't have hurt her at all. Why isn't it the fault of the cotton sweatpants manufacturer for not putting a warning on the sweatpants? Don't spill hot coffee on this because it will cause more of a burn than if you were wearing something safer. And the point I'd like to make is you hold the liability within where the proximate cause is. The proximate cause of Stella Liebeck's injuries, as terrible as they were, was Stella Liebeck. And that's where the liability should have sat. And instead, a judge and a jury imposed liability on the deep pocket. The trial court eventually reduced the damages to $640,000, triple punitive damages, and the case settled for some unknown amount, though it's thought to be close to $640,000. Both sides appealed, obviously. Let's move to the second case, and I'll go through this quickly because I spent a long time on coffee. The McDonald's obesity suits, and about 7 or 8 years ago, there was a headline in The Onion Hershey, lawsuit claims $375 billion from Hershey chocolate for big food causing obesity. And it was a satire on the big tobacco settlements that had happened. And it's the same principle. Somebody's smoking and has health problems because they were smoking. Well, is that the fault of the tobacco companies or is that the fault of the smoker? And the satire was, well, why not for food? And some entrepreneurial trial lawyers apparently looked at the Onion headline and said, hey, they're right. This is just like the tobacco lawsuits. So a lawyer in New York found a 14-year-old teenage girl named Ashley Pellman, who was 4'10" and weighed 140 pounds, and had been eating McDonald's 3 to 5 times a week. Whether that was because of her parents or despite her parents, I don't know. But they brought a punitive class action saying, this is McDonald's fault. I ate McDonald's for so long that I'm going to have all these health problems now. And again, we have the same issue of personal responsibility. Whose fault is it that somebody has eaten too much McDonald's? Is it McDonald's fault? Is McDonald's supposed to card you each time you come in and say, no, you're over your limit for the week? Or is it the person's individual responsibility? And then you also have sort of a causation issue, right? Because obesity is not just a function of eating too much, it's also a function of exercising too little. So are television shows at fault for being too entertaining and keeping people sitting down instead of reading? Am I liable because you're all sitting here for an hour instead of out running around in the 90-degree heat? We have all these labor-saving devices. For example, automatic dishwashers probably contribute to the national obesity problem because instead of people exercising by scrubbing dishes and drying dishes, it's now done by a dishwasher. Instead of spending 10 calories a day rolling up your window and rolling down your window as you did when I was a kid, that's how old I am, you now have automatic window, and you just press a button and the window goes up and the window goes down. If that's 10 calories a day that you're not exercising because you're not rolling up and down your window, over the course of a year, that's over 3,600 calories. That's a pound a year, or 10 pounds in a decade. So the causes of obesity we've moved from a society where people used to pay you to exercise to a society where you have to pay a gym to exercise. The problem of obesity is certainly a real social one, but do you blame the people who are selling the food? This class action has been sort of bouncing around in the courts for several years. It's not really clear where it is. For a while, trial lawyers were really excited that big food cases would be just like big tobacco cases. But while people sort of bought into the tobacco cases, they never really bought into the food cases. Public polling showed 90% of Americans thought they were ridiculous. So the next big thing of obesity lawsuits never really happened, which I would suggest is a good thing in the long run. There was a stretch where everybody in the fast food industry got scared about the possibility of these lawsuits and started offering salads. Nobody bought the salads. You'll see we have 20 bags of McDonald's back there, and I don't think there are any salads in them. And now everybody's gone in the opposite direction, and they're offering the 900-calorie killer burgers. This is what people want from the fast food markets. Now you can say fast food restaurants shouldn't sell this stuff. But again, is that a decision that you want made by a jury, or do you want that made by a legislature or a regulator? Very interestingly, regulators have come in and said, well, let's do something about the fast food and the obesity problem. So they said, in New York, put all your calorie counts for each menu item on the menu so that when somebody buys an item off the menu, they see how many calories they're consuming. The fast food companies turned out to be perfectly happy with that, and that's for two reasons. First of all, it's very expensive to sit there and calculate calories, so it ended up serving as a barrier to entry from future competition because it's harder for the smaller restaurants. If they got too big, they would have to start counting the calories, putting it on the menu boards, and that would be expensive. It would raise their cost. They'd be unable to compete with somebody like McDonald's that has thousands and thousands of restaurants. But the other interesting issue, and this is sort of the human factors issue, is that the restaurants found that if you put a really big calorie item on the menu, you know, 700 calories, 900 calories, somebody will buy the 500 calorie burger and think they're being virtuous. And it turned out that putting the calorie counts on the menu actually increased the number of calories people would buy from McDonald's and other fast food restaurants. Similarly, there have been schools that have, you know, banned candy, and that all that's done is create some mildly wealthy entrepreneurial students who have a black market in candy selling. So it's a public policy problem, but the solutions aren't necessarily obvious. And litigation is a very clumsy way to approach it. The third case, and I'm sorry that I'm going to have to rush through it, because it's a fascinating one that you probably haven't heard of. You may have seen it, the adaptation of it on Law & Order. Robin Williams played the bad guy in that one. But there's a fellow by the name of Michael Stewart in Florida. And Mr. Stewart was somehow a very persuasive fellow. And what he would do is that he would call up lots and lots of fast food restaurants until he'd find somebody who he could persuade that he was a member of the local police and that the people in the restaurant needed to investigate a crime, and the way that the crime would be investigated is that somebody would be taking off their clothes. And for some reason, dozens of restaurants fell for this, or dozens of managers fell for this. So he was able to talk a manager. I think one of your customers is a sexual offender. We have an undercover cop in the restaurant. Take off all your clothes and walk up to him, and we'll see if we can provoke him into attacking you. And people would do this. Now, you know, you think if you had the power to persuade like that, go into like real estate sales, or, you know, or if you wanted to use it for evil, become governor of Alaska. But still, this is how he decided to use his talents. And there was a very tragic incident in Kentucky where he got a particularly gullible manager, and got calls. Calls her up on the phone and says, "Do you happen to have a young teenage employee with dark hair?" And the manager says, "Yes, Louise Ogborn. How do you know?" "Well, we suspect her of theft. So if you can take her in the back room, we're going to have a cop there eventually. But if you can take her in the back room and I'll give you instructions." And for an hour, this manager interrogated Louise Ogborn, had her take off all her clothes, strip searched her. And this is going on for an hour. The police department is, you know, a quarter mile away. No police are coming, but the manager's still, you know, talking on the phone to our friend in Florida. And the manager says, "Well, you know, I've been doing this for an hour. I got to get back to the counter and do what managers do at McDonald's." And they says, "Well, do you have anybody else who can watch her?" And they try to get the janitor to watch her, and the janitor says, I don't want any part of this." And the janitor is smarter than the manager. But the manager says, "Well, my fiancé can come watch her." So the manager calls up her fiancé and has the fiancé in the back room with the naked teenager. And the fiancé is now on a fellow by the name of Nix, N-I-X, and the caller has Nix have Louise Ogborn do all sorts of things. Well, you know, have her do jumping jacks, see if something falls out. Have her sit on your lap, and if she won't sit on your lap, spank her. And this goes on for 2 hours. And at some point, whether it's at the behest of the caller or not, unfortunately, there's already been basically a sexual assault, but it goes further, and there's a real sexual assault. Now, Nix is starting to feel awkward about this. or so he says. But after 2 hours of this, he goes back to his fiance and says, I can't keep watching her. You need to get somebody else. At this point, so they call up, they ask another maintenance worker, can you watch her? And the maintenance worker says, what the heck are you doing? Very belatedly, the light bulb goes over the head. Hey, it's been 3 hours, and there aren't any cops here, and this is a strip search, and this is weird. Mr. Stewart in Florida had told the manager that he has the other manager of the restaurant on the other line. At this point, the manager calls up the other manager and says, are you on the line with the police? And of course, she's not. This is just something Mr. Stewart made up. They realize what's happened and tells the teenager, go ahead, get dressed, take the rest of the day off. Eventually the police are called in. They watch the security tape of all of this that has happened and Nix is arrested for rape and the manager, Summers, is also arrested. Nix pleads guilty, sentenced to 5 years. Summers pleads guilty to a misdemeanor or makes an Alford plea, more technically. Not that there's a great difference. And is also sentenced to jail time. And there's a lawsuit over this. And, you know, as well, there should be. There's some pretty severe intentional torts here. But, of course, the target is the deep pocket, McDonald's. And the theory of the case is you, McDonald's, should have had training to tell us what to do when somebody like this calls. Now, McDonald's already has something in the manual saying no strip searches allowed, and that warning in the employee manual was disregarded by everybody. McDonald's says, wait a second, you know, this is the manager's fiance who did the vast majority of the harm, and it's the guy who's calling. We're way, way back in the, you know, you list all the possible guilty parties here, and we're got to be sixth or seventh on the list. A jury awards millions and millions of dollars to Ms. Ogborn, and more ridiculously, over $1 million to the manager, Ms. Summers, whose foolishness caused all of this to happen in the first place. And part of that award has been upheld by a Kentucky appellate court. I'm not sure whether it's been appealed to the Kentucky Supreme Court yet, but that's where that case is. And again, we're seeing the same theme here. Somebody who does something wrong, and they're seeking to blame the deep pocket. They're seeking to expand the scope of liability to somebody pretty down the chain in the realm of proximate cause. Now, Ms. Ogborn, she might have a different case. You have the doctrine of respondeat superior. Now it's the manager acting within the scope of employment when she has her fiancé to come over and watch a naked employee for 2 hours. Probably not, but that you can argue that's for a jury to decide, but surely the manager does not have a cause of action against McDonald's. You shouldn't have told me to be. You should have told me not to be so stupid. Interestingly, and perhaps doubly tragically, this case did result in Mr. Stewart getting caught. He'd been doing this for years and years and years, but this time he used a phone card. They were able to track which phone card he used. There was another case in Massachusetts, and they were investigating the case, and they also had a phone card that was a different phone card. They figured out the phone cards were purchased at particular Walmarts. Somebody sat through all the security tapes until they found two people who looked alike who happened to buy phone cards from these two different Walmarts. Both times the person was wearing a uniform that identified his employer. They went to the employer with a composite photo, and the employer said, that's Michael Stewart. They searched Michael Stewart's house. And he has a phone card there that's been used to call several fast food restaurants across the nation. But when he's tried for his crimes in Kentucky, he's acquitted. And in part, that's because when the victims got on the stand to say, Michael Stewart did this, and the call was made, and this happened, and that happened, the defense attorney was able to cross-examine them and say, you sued McDonald's for millions of dollars, aren't you? Didn't you? I mean, you have an incentive to say all this happened, and was able to imply to the jury that all of this was just sort of made up to make money. So in effect, the civil suit not only acted to punish the innocent party, McDonald's, but it helped the most culpable party, or at worst, the second most culpable party, to go scot-free. And at least the pranks have stopped. If you can call these pranks, they can be pretty traumatic to the victims. And when we talk about tort reform, that's often what we're talking about, the idea of cabining liability to the most culpable parties and not expanding the doctrine of proximate cause to sweep out and scoop up somebody who happens to have the most money or happens to have the money that can pay an outsized damage award. And yes, that might mean that somebody who is actually injured might have to bear the own expenses for their injury. But in the long run, that is fairer for everybody than forcing the innocent deep pocket to bear those costs. Because in the long run, we end up paying for that. If McDonald's can't sit there and say, are you going to spill this coffee on yourself? They just have to raise the price of coffee if they're going to be held liable every time somebody spills coffee on themselves. Or they have to not sell coffee that otherwise people would want to buy and continue to buy to this day. There's certainly tort reforms out there that are merely wealth redistributions from plaintiffs to defendants, but a good tort reform, one that's good for society, is one that cabins the role of liability acts in a way to increase certainty and fairness in the system. I look forward to hearing the professor and taking your questions. Thank you.
Well, I want to say thank you to Mr. Frank for coming, and I enjoyed his presentation. I think you're going to find that we probably are not all that far apart on a lot of the issues. I'm going to come at it from a little bit different angle. When I was asked to do this last week or so, I think I was home down the line in terms of choices, and that's the appropriate thing because although I teach torts, labor and employment law is my specialty. But I'm glad to do it. I enjoy torts. And when I looked at, I wanted to find out some of the things that Mr. Frank had said, some of the things he had written about. And when I looked at his resume, it was daunting because he is a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School. He was a law clerk on the Seventh Circuit for Judge Easterbrook. He's a member of the American Law Institute, and he's the founder and president of the Center for Class Action Fairness. So when I looked at that, I said, we've got a serious person coming here to speak on these issues. And my thought was, since torts is kind of my part-time thing, this is almost going to be like putting the North Carolina reserves up against the LSU starters. It's a mismatch. But then again, I hope I hold my own as well as North Carolina's reserves did. This came a whole lot closer than I expected, and I was there to see it, so it was scary. One of the things, I'm kind of a weird responder on this because I was a defense attorney. I worked for a defense firm in practice, and I worked with the Louisiana Association of Defense Counsel as my side job. So, you know, I'm very defense-oriented in terms of where I come from on this, but I try, as far as being a law professor, to be objective and kind of call it down the middle on this. But very few people have ever said, you know, that liberal, plaintiff-oriented law professor. I don't get much of that. But I think what I want to say about this is we probably agree on the individual cases a lot. As far as the strip search case, when I saw the result in that one, I made it a torts exam. Anybody take that on my torts exam? As soon as I saw it, yep, I threw it on there in a hurry, modified the facts and put it on there because it made great intentional torts and vicarious liability issues. That one does trouble me. I mean, it seems to me way off. But one comment on that, and I'm going to back away from the individual cases in a minute, but as far as I think it's wrong in several ways. I think it's a bad result to impose liability. But as Mr. Frank suggested, when you talk about vicarious liability, you get some weird results. It's somebody in the course and scope of their employment, and I've seen a lot of cases, and I use them in torts and say, I don't think I would have found this one in the course and scope, but the court stretches a bit, and that happens occasionally, the course and scope. And what I think has happened is, Ms. Frank Morey, who teaches torts and writes a treatise on torts, has often said, common sense ain't that common anymore, if it ever was. And, you know, that's what you see in some of the vicarious liability cases. You see a supervisor do something like this, strip search an employee, contrary to company policy, and call her fiancé to watch over the person, and you think, how stupid can you be? And why would a manager do such things? And yet there are a lot of cases where employees and supervisors and managers are doing stupid, gullible things. And yet you look at it and say, well, you know, is discipline of employees, is supervising employees within the course and scope of their employment? Or sometimes say, yeah, I don't think they should have done that, but it seems to be in the course and scope. So I know where that case is coming from, but I do find it to be a very troublesome result in the case. As far as obesity suits, I think Mr. Frank has said in some of his writings, which I enjoy very much, you know, the courts usually have gotten those right. They usually see it and say, well, no, we're not going to impose liability there. And that's one of the reasons why in those cases I think the courts have generally gotten them right, and I don't know that there's a lot of need for legislation in that area. When it comes to tort reform, I often ask, well, are the courts handling this well? Is too much cost being imposed? And on the obesity lawsuits, I'm not so sure that it was. So it's one where I'm not sure there needed to be a legislative response. I think the courts have basically gotten them right. Brings us up to the Liebeck case, and it's one that I use in my torts class early on in the introduction. And I don't really use it for the substance of the case. We were talking about this before, about whether you think the result was right or wrong, but I use it to mainly illustrate how polarizing tort law can be. That this case becomes the poster child in both camps, if you will. I said, go ahead, get on the internet and find conservative, right-wing organizations, find liberal, plaintiff-oriented organizations, and they're going to have this case on there, and they're going to give you their take on it. And so it is, as Mr. Frank says, it's a cause celeb. It caught the attention of the nation, it caught the attention of organizations, and it becomes a poster child of the case. And that's the main reason I bring it up in tort law, is to talk about how that happens and how, you know, politics and societal views can come into play in a case. As far as the case itself, and this is where I want to get into the systemic issues, I'm not troubled by the case. As I said, I think I'm more defense-oriented than plaintiffs probably, but I look at the case and say, big deal. It doesn't bother me. And the reason is because you win some and you lose some. I think, and this is where I want to back up and say some things about the tort system, and that is, what do we expect the tort system to do, and do we think that it generally works? And I think it generally works. That is, we put cases in the hands of judges and juries and hope they will resolve them well. And on balance, I think they do. Do they miss some? That is, do they decide somewhere either the defendant or the plaintiff looks at it, or you or I look at it and say, I don't think I would have done it like that. Yes, absolutely. That just doesn't trouble me as far as the system goes, unless they miss it terribly and impose so much liability that it's going to skew what a business does. And the Liebeck case, I mean, again, I think it's debatable how the case should have come out, but that's why it doesn't bother me. It went to a jury. The jury decided it. It came back. The judge used remediator to reduce what he considered to be an excessive verdict in the case. And I say, well, you know, $600,000, that may be a bit much, but McDonald's not going out of business over this one. Is the coffee going to be a little cooler? Maybe. They've got to decide on that one. They're putting warnings on the cups. I think they had them even before. But systemically, it just really doesn't trouble me, because backing up from the case now, what I would say about it is this. If you think about the tort system and you say, how do we want it to operate? Some people say, well, you know, theoretically, let's do this theoretically, we want it to be corrective justice. We want the right result in cases. We want justice done between the parties. Well, I don't think businesses generally want a corrective justice system. They want a system that economically, in terms of instrumental views, policy, will keep us on the right path for where we want society moving. Economically, they want to be able to make decisions. So, you know, you and I, if we're suing, we want corrective justice. I want to be done right. Well, you know, it may not work that way. Policy and the right result for society might move us in a different direction. So I don't think businesses want the right result in every case. I think they want an economically efficient tort system. I think McDonald's got it, even though they probably didn't like the result in the case. $600,000 didn't break them. They didn't like the result. But on balance, they know how to move forward. And it seems to me, if it bothers you and you say, oh, she shouldn't have gotten that money, well, there are a lot of cases McDonald's won that they maybe shouldn't have. There are a lot of cases that were never filed. And I'm not really picking on McDonald's here. Look, you got cases you probably got to go file against businesses that you're never going to file. Well, you know, sometimes they get hit with a big one, and this wasn't all that big, but there are plenty of cases that are never filed. So on balance, it doesn't seem to me that the system is malfunctioning. Now, I would agree if we get to a product or a service and there are judgments coming in throughout the nation, jury verdicts, class actions, whatever, that are skewing the system. They're so high that either the product or service becomes unaffordable or it's no longer offered. Well, then we got maybe a malfunctioning system. But McDonald's still serving coffee, and it's hot. Whether it's as hot as we want it, I don't know. Seems pretty hot to me. But the Livebeck case didn't kill McDonald's. It doesn't seem to me systemically it's all that bad a result. Again, I think it's debatable. But let me mention something about the McDonald's approach to that case, and that is the other issue. This goes to very practical considerations for businesses. Businesses understand that they're going to pay some money in litigation. And as a matter of fact, every one of you here today wants that to happen. Whether you're on the plaintiff side or the defense side, litigation cost is not going to bother you a bit. Defendants do not want to drive plaintiff's attorneys out of business, because if they did, well, then they wouldn't be making money either. But businesses understand that part of what we do with our court system and our tort system is they're going to have some litigation cost. It's true in employment, it's true in torts, it's true in everything. So the question is, how do you manage that risk? Do you understand the rules sufficiently to be able to do that? Now, it seems to me McDonald's understands the system pretty well. They look at cases and they decide what to do about those cases. I mean, defense attorneys advise their clients on this all the time. I certainly did it in practice. Mr. Frank's done it in practice. You will do it in practice. And so you make a decision about what to do with a case when it is filed. And the Livebeck case doesn't make any sense to me to push that one to trial. Now, I think Mr. Frank has said, as I said, I've read some of his writings on this, you can't really blame McDonald's for deciding to try the case. And I don't. They looked at the case and they decided about whether they wanted to try the Livebeck case or not. And they did. They thought the settlement offer that she was, what she was demanding, something along $30,000 or so, was too much. Was it too much? I don't know, maybe it was. But I've got a question whether you want to try that case. The 79-year-old woman who was burned and has skin grafts, now you can say, well, it's her fault, she shouldn't have done that. I'm getting a little more sympathetic with older people as I get older. When they get injured, they just don't heal as fast. I'm beginning to understand this. If you said, do you really want to try this case to a jury, I don't know. So I'm not so sure it's the handling of the case, but the decision to push the case as far as they pushed it. I don't blame them for it. That's fine. If that's their business decision to do that, they do that. But when it comes in and you get popped by a jury on occasion, and again, $600,000 is not going to take McDonald's down the drain, but just don't whine too loudly about the case. And, you know, I'm not sure that McDonald's did. It got blown up for lots of reasons. But I just think it's a decision that you make on a practical level. McDonald's made it. They got what they got. It wasn't that devastating, but I think you have to expect that some cases will work like that. So on balance, I think that usually the tort system works. Do you get some outlier cases where it bothers you? Yeah, I see them all the time. I mean, all of us will see cases where we say, I wouldn't have done it that way. I think the result should have been different. But to me, for businesses, the question is, do we have a system that you can function in and make efficient decisions? And I think generally we do. Now, there are some things I would agree that systemically you have to look at it and say, this is going to skew the system. And class actions sometimes are like that. That is, can you manage the risk with the possibility of a class action? You may not. Walmart's got one right now that's pending out on the West Coast, and I'm not sure that, you know, if they get 1.5 million plaintiffs in that case, that may skew the system a bit. So there are some big procedural issues I understand need to be dealt with, but the individual cases, generally speaking, I think are less troublesome from the big picture as far as what the system does. You know, we could disagree about the results of the case, but the system generally works, I think, pretty well. Sometimes you need legislation if the system is way off. To me, and I haven't studied them that carefully, but the obesity lawsuits are not such a case. I think the courts were taking care of those pretty well. It didn't seem to me there was much need for legislative correction in those cases. But, Mr. Frank, I appreciate you coming. I think it's a very provocative topic and interesting issues in torts.
So I guess maybe we were part of the problem getting 200 cheeseburgers for today. But we can have question and answers. We have time for a couple. Anybody? Questions?
Yeah, as far as the effect of the signaling effect in terms of, you know, if somebody's successful with a lawsuit, that it adds blood to the water as far as sharks are concerned, are you concerned with the idea that these successful lawsuits are going to lead to a proliferation?
I think that's right, and you see this effect in a lot of different places. One place where I want to disagree with what was just said, you know, $600,000 by itself, you know, that's not going to nick McDonald's that much. But the problem is that that includes punitive damages. And the next coffee spill case comes in, and the lawyer stands up and says, McDonald's paid $600,000 in punitive damages, and they're still selling hot coffee. They needed to be taught a lesson, and you need to send them a message. And, you know, I say if you want to send a message, use Western Union rather than the court system. But you will get that speech, and you will get bigger damages the next time, and bigger damages in the case after that. And then McDonald's will eventually be faced with a decision. Do we keep taking this hit because the courts keep getting this wrong and we don't want to, you know, fix it? Or do we stop selling hot coffee? And people want hot coffee. You know, if people didn't want hot coffee and they, you know, some Burger King would come out and say, we have tepid coffee. Come get our lukewarm coffee and you'll never burn yourself. But you don't see them doing that. You see Starbucks selling coffee hotter than McDonald's. And you know, people have, and McDonald's now is trying to compete with Starbucks and their coffee sales. So, you know, you really lose something if these go unchecked. Now, I agree to the extent that you say, okay, you know, we can't expect perfection from our court system, and occasionally a judge and a jury is going to get it wrong. And if that was all that was happening here, I would agree and say, what's the big deal? But that's not all that's happening, because the trial lawyers are out there trying to tell the American public and future lawyers, no, this is the way it should be. Every Stella Liebeck out there should be collecting millions of dollars, and McDonald's should be driven out of business for this, and we should never have hot coffee because it might burn somebody if they spill it on themselves.
Anything?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. McDonald's did what they did in the settlement, and so we have some track record to see if this has resulted in a lot more lawsuits where they get hit with substantial damages in coffee. And I don't know if that's happened.
I mean, there are lots of lawsuits, and courts get them right still so far. I mean, they're consistently thrown out, and the Liebeck case is still an outlier. Again, my concern is not so much that there's an outlier. My concern is that there is a movement afoot to sort. If you Google this case, you'll see the Wikipedia entry first. You'll see a blog post I wrote about it third or fourth, and the other eight entries are trial lawyers debunking the myths about the case and saying she should have collected, she should have gotten millions of dollars, and over time, that's going to change our legal system. You're going to have a generation of lawyers who think that the right result is Stella Liebeck should collect, and all the other courts that ruled the other way were the ones that were wrong. And that's going to be a bad societal result.
Yes?
It kind of seems as though you're saying, even if the coffee was like 200 degrees above like industry standards, that it would still have been okay for McDonald's to have won. And it would have been okay if McDonald's won the lawsuit. And I don't see how that could be possible if that was, that's how I feel like you're implying that they still should have, like McDonald's shouldn't have to take the blame because it was her fault that she wasted the coffee, even though if the coffee was 200 degrees over industry standards.
Well, if it was 200 degrees over industry standards, it would be steam. You know, if people wanted to buy coffee steam from McDonald's, they should have the right to do so, assuming McDonald's decided to market that product. I don't see why that would happen. But let's say it's 10 degrees,
yeah.
Right? It's a marketing decision. I think if McDonald's sold coffee 10 degrees hotter than it should be, people would say, wow, this is unpleasant to drink. I don't want to drink this. And the market would certainly constrain McDonald's that way. Now, you know, if McDonald's sold coffee that exploded once every 10 times or something like that, well, you don't expect coffee to explode, and that would be unreasonably dangerous. But you do expect coffee to be hot. And you know that hot things burn because we're over 5 years old. The question of, you know, should there be a bigger warning? No, we really need it. This is hot.
How high do I expect it to be is what I was saying. Like, should I expect it to be industry standards? And if it's over industry standards, should they be held liable for me expecting that it wasn't that hot?
Well, if you think there's a problem out there of vendors, if we were concerned as a society that there are vendors out there deciding that they wanted to enter their customers and sell coffee unreasonably hot, I think we could address it through legislation. Don't sell your coffee. You know, when I was a kid, you could buy a raw hamburger at the Comida Grill. And you can't do that anymore. Now, are we better off because I can't get the cannibal burger at the Camellia Grill? That's what it was called. It was a raw burger, raw onion, raw egg. And New Orleans passed a law saying all burgers have to be cooked medium well or better, or medium or better. And so that wasn't sold anymore. Let's do it through the democratic process is what I'm saying.
Professor Corbett, you want to
go? Yeah, let me just say one thing. I would be concerned, too, as Mr. Frank suggests, that if American society we're moving in the direction of, because trial lawyers and other organizations put something on the internet saying, look, you don't know the facts of that case, they got it right. If that or other cases, which we can debate the merits of the case, people are going to say, oh, well then, what we ought to do is buy into that notion. But you know, what I find, we'll see, this is extrapolation about what's going to happen in the future, but in employment law, I see a lot of cases, the ridiculous cases, Americans with Disabilities Act cases, the poster child cases that come out, and I don't really see people say, oh, that's right, that was the right result. What I see more is people say, that's ridiculous, this is frivolous litigation, and sometimes, you know, I think the Americans with Disabilities Act, for instance, has been painted with a brush that everything under it's ridiculous, which is not true. But I find myself battling that notion because a lot of the cases get held up and people say, see how ridiculous it is. And I, although I'm not plaintiffs oriented, tend to come back and say, well, it's not ridiculous. You need to understand the underlying. So, I mean, I guess we'll see, but I just don't see, you know, I know we're a litigious society, but I don't know that I see people moving in the direction of saying, oh, that case, like Liebeck or some other case, yeah, that's the way it ought to be. I don't know. I mean, I don't see that result happening. I would be concerned, too, because that would skew our perception of how things ought to come out. But I really don't see that. I mean, I don't know.
I think that we need to cut it short because I think you guys have class after this, the one else. If you can clean up your trash, that would greatly expedite the cleanup process. Who dat, go Saints. Thanks again to our speakers.